And hello, good morning. Welcome to another edition of Quest Community Vibration. And now it is time for us to begin. How are you? Good morning once again. But I want to say that a cornucopia of physics dictates that where there are vibrations, there must be a medium. And all vibrations possess a wave nature. You see, in our community, our art is in fact and in spirit the medium through which the waves travel. Where there is no medium, there are no vibrations. Now, this morning we have, as every morning, we have panel guests who have joined us for our program. And I would like for our student host, Walter Pierce, to introduce our first panel guest.
Yes. Good morning, everybody. And again, welcome to Quest Youth Radio, the best youth radio. And for our first segment of the day, I would like to introduce Mr. Shelton Harris. Mr. Harris, you can begin.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I was going through some ideas and stuff in my head. And given the times that we're living in and what's really going on in our country right now, I was looking back at this to see what other kind of instances were going on that kind of reflect what's going on today. So that's going to be our chain of events today. And it's a speech. It's not really a poem. It's a speech that was given by El-Haj Malik Shabazz, and it was called The Ballot or the Bullet. I'm going to give an excerpt. It was very long and drawn out, but it was very informative. He starts out, but before we try to explain what is meant by the ballot or the bullet, I would like to clarify something concerning myself. I'm still a Muslim. My religion is still Islam. That's my personal belief. Just as Adam Clayton Powell and is a Christian minister that heads the Abyssinian Church in New York, but at the same time takes part in political struggles to try and bring rights to the black people in this country. And Dr. Martin Luther King is a Christian minister down in Atlanta, who has another organization fighting for civil rights and the black people in this country. And Reverend Galamanis, I guess you've heard of him, is another Christian minister in New York who has been deeply involved in the school boycotts and to eliminate segregated education. Well, I myself am a minister, not a Christian minister, but a Muslim minister. And I believe in action on all fronts by whatever means necessary. Although I'm a Muslim, I'm not here tonight to discuss my religion. I'm here to try and bring change. And I'm not here to bring change to your religion. I'm here to argue for and discuss anything that we differ about, because it's time for us to submerge our differences and realize that it's best for us first to see what we have in common. We have a common problem, a problem that will make you catch hell, whether you're a Baptist or a Methodist or a Muslim or a nationalist, whether you're educated or illiterate, whether you live on the boulevard or in the alley. You're going to catch the same hell as I do. We're all in the same boat. We all are going to catch the same hell from the same man. He just happens to be the white man. All of us have suffered here in this country, political oppression at the hands of the white man, economic exploitation at the hands of the white man, and social degradation at the hands of the white man. Now, in speaking like this, I don't mean to say we're anti-white, but it does mean that we're anti-exploitation and we're anti-degradation, anti-oppression. And if the white man doesn't want us to be anti him, let him stop oppressing and exploiting and degrading us. Whether we are Christians or Muslims or nationalists or agnostics or atheists, we must first learn to forget our differences. If we have differences, let us differ in the closet. When we come out in front, let us not have anything to argue about until we finish arguing with this man. If the late President Kennedy could get together with Khrushchev and exchange some wheat, we can certainly have more in common than each of them did. If we don't do something really soon, I think you'll have to agree that we're going to be forced to either use the ballot or the bullet. It's one or the other in 1964. It isn't that time is running out. It's that time has run out. Now, I'm not a politician, not even a student of politics. In fact, I'm a student of not much at all. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I don't even consider myself American. If you and I were Americans, there'd be no problem. These honkies just got off the boat. They're already Americans. Polacks are already Americans. The Italian refugees are already Americans. Everything that came off from Europe, every blue-eyed thing is already American. And as long as you and I have been here, we aren't Americans yet. Well, I'm one who doesn't believe in deluding myself. I'm not going to sit back at the table and watch you eat with nothing on my plate and call myself a diner. Sitting at the table doesn't make you a diner unless you're eating something that's on the plate. Being here in America doesn't make you an American. Being born here in America doesn't make you an American. Why? If birth made you an American, we wouldn't need any legislation. We wouldn't need any amendments to the Constitution. You wouldn't be faced with civil rights filibustering in Washington. They don't have to pass civil rights legislation to make a Polack an American. No, I'm not American. I'm one of the 22 million black people who are victims of Americanism. One of the 22 million black people who are victims of democracy. Nothing but disguised hypocrisy. So I'm not standing here speaking to you as an American, as a patriot, or as a flag saluter or flag waver. No, I'm speaking as a victim of this American system. And I see America through the eyes of the victim. I don't see America in dream. I see America in nightmare. There are 22 million victims waking up. Their eyes are coming open. They're beginning to see what they used to only look at. They're becoming politically mature. They're realizing that there's a new political trends from coast to coast. As they see these new political trends, it's possible for them to see that every time there's an election, races are so close that they have to have a recount. They had to recount in Massachusetts to see if there was going to be a governor. It was so close. It was the same thing in Rhode Island, in Minnesota, and many other places in the country. And the same with Kennedy and Nixon when they ran for president. It was so close they had to have a recount all over again. Well, what does this mean? It means that when white people are evenly divided, the black people have the block of votes of their own, and it's left up to them to decide who's going to be in the White House and who's going to be in the doghouse. It was a black man's vote that put the present administration in office in D.C. Your vote, your dumb vote, your ignorant vote, your wasted vote put an administration in Washington that seemed fit to pass every kind of legislation imaginable, saving you until last, then filibustering on top of that. And your and my leaders have the audacity to come around clapping their hands and talking about how much progress we're making and what a good president we have. If he wasn't good in Texas, he sure can't be good in Washington, D.C., because Texas is a lynch state. It's the same breadth as Mississippi, no different. They only lynch you in Texas with a Texas accent and lynch you in Mississippi with a Mississippi accent. And those Negro leaders have the audacity to go and have some coffee in the White House with the Texan, a Southern cracker. That's all he is. And when come out and tell you that he's going to be better for us because since he's from the South, he knows how to deal with Southerners. Some kind of lie. What kind of logic is that? Let Eastland be the president. He's from the South, too. He should be better able to deal with them than Johnson. So it's time in 1964 to wake up. And when you see them coming with that kind of conspiracy, let them know that your eyes are open. Let them know something else is going to be wide open, too. It's got to be the ballot or the bullet. The ballot or the bullet. If you're afraid to use that expression like that, you should go back to the country. You should leave the country. You should go back to the cotton patches. You should get back in the alley. They all get the Negro vote, and after that, the Negro gets nothing in return. All they did when they got to Washington was give a few big black Negroes big jobs. Those big Negroes didn't need big jobs. They already had jobs. That's camouflage. That's trickery. That's treachery. Window dressing. I'm not trying to mock the Democrats or for the Republicans. We'll get to them in a minute. But it is true. You put the Democrats first, and the Democrats put you last. All right, this is a very long speech, so I'm going to stop right here because this is a long and powerful speech, and anything this powerful needs to be broken down in order to be truly digested. We're on the eve of another election that is, as they always say, is the most important vote of your life. Well, what's in it for us? We have forgotten the tactic of leaving our differences in the closet and coming out with a united front. That is one of the most destructive things that we do as a people. The Panthers said the only way to fight oppression and racism is with unity. Malcolm said it before him. Elijah Muhammad said it before him. Marcus Garvey said it before him. Delaney said it before him. And we still haven't taken heed to this yet. The ballot of the bullet.
So I have to ask you, what exactly, you know, when I hear this excerpt, what message are you trying to deliver? What is your motivation for actually, even though you said you feel as though it relates to today, exactly how does it relate today to what's going on today?
Yeah, well, there's, you know, a lot of people have been jumping on this brother Ice Cube for this for his interpretation of what he thinks we need to have from our political leaders, and the fact that he went to both sides looking for some kind of understanding. And one of them gave you the delusion that, yeah, all right, I'm going to listen to you, but I really can't do nothing for you right now. The other one gave you some reality and said, I'm not even going to listen to you right now. Wait till after the election. And this is the kind of thing that we've been going through in this country for forever. As soon as ever since the Emancipation Proclamation, we've been looking for a way to become a part of this country on an equal basis with everybody else. And every election, there's always some kind of division amongst ourselves. You know, because Malcolm was saying that we need to put all our differences to the side and we need to come as a unified front. Because these elections are always real close. You can even see today, this election is very close, and it's not like a slam shot for either side. And because of that, our block of voting as people of color, we can change the direction of what's going on in this country if we would only unify. And this is something Malcolm was talking about 56 years ago, and people before him was talking about before that, if we're going to vote anyway.
Okay. No, not at all. Because when I was asking you the questions, I was basically concerned about the fact that I was being redundant, and so you know, I had to, you know, just to the best of my ability get your point, and I think you did that. But I need to open up the floor and ask Ms. Gardner. Tanisha, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hello? You hear me?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Do you have a question or a comment for Mr. Harris?
Oh, wow. I guess I have a comment. I heard that when I was a teenager, Ballad of the Bullet. That is very powerful. I guess looking at now, everything's still the same. It didn't make a difference. It's just KKK. They just as you said, they in suits and ties. White supremacy never changed. It will never change. It will always be here. Like I said before, you got to remember every empire reflects themselves. So why do we expect the empire to change? The only way that it can change is for us, like you said, for us to be unified and be able to uplift ourselves out of this. You know, so it's like we have to wake up. And they know that. They know who we are. And that's why they put so much pressure on the negativity aspect of what they think I guess, the delusion of who they think we are, because they know the power that we have. You know, throughout centuries and throughout the beginning of the world, we were always here, and we had the power to dictate and create what we see now. You know, when you look at Europeans, it's the same thing. You know, when you study the Moors, when the Moors came into Europe, and they taught them how to clean, they taught them how to be sanitized. So we have to remember who we are, and we lost who we are, and now we have to come back into our senses of who we are and step into the role play of being leaders again, of being, you know, productive again. You know, without us, America would have been failed. You know, because we were the workers. We were the ideology of what you believe America should have been. And the same thing with the Native Indians, you know, the indigenous. It's the same thing. So at the end of the day, ballot of the bullet, you know, and that's real talk. And what Trump said to the Proud Boys, he said, stand back and stand by. And the same thing with us. We got to come as a collective force. Like the same thing, we're going to stand back and stand by too, because you're not going to come in. Everything is about self-preservation. Not to say that we're going to start some massive revolution. No, we're going to protect our own, you know, and it's about us all coming together, you know, as a front of, I guess, as the human race. You know, like you said, you have negative and positive. Which side do you choose? And at the end of the day, we're going to protect our own. So the ballot or the bullet.
Okay.
And at the end of the day, like, yeah, you say you had a ballot, but at the end of the day, they vote for who they want in. So it's I don't know, it's time for change. That's all I got to say. It's time for change. People need to wake up, know who you are, and just, I don't know. I'm going to just stop right there.
Well, you do know, and you did a good job. Student host Walter Fear, do you have a question or a comment?
I have a question based on what you were talking about with the unity and the politics, especially with that. Like, because in my opinion, I don't like how people constantly debate. Because I believe when people debate too much, it just gets to a point where only one side is going to benefit and the other side is just going to negatively have a negative impact. And I believe that if people would do more reasoning and talking, there would be more benefits on both sides. So, like, what do you think about political debates and how it affects how it's one-sided? And do you believe that it's negative or it's beneficial for our country?
Debating is showing who has the cunning wit to be able to seduce you of what they're saying. So some you know, when it comes to debate, either you're truthful or you're not, or I guess as they say, it's a white lie in between. So I guess when it comes to politicians really know they don't. They answer to others, you know, like I guess when you think about our government, we got to remember our government is not a government. It's a corporation. You got to remember the United States is a corporation and they don't tell us this. So we are backed by different entities. Like I'm just put out one like the Bilderberg Group or the Council of Foreign Relations. When you think of these groups, these are major groups that's worldwide and they have strict policy that's going to dictate how and what and how everything is going to move. So when they debating in the back end, they know half of what they're doing is not going to happen because it's not going to be what the top want. So in a debate, it's like how do you persuade the masses on a level of where they're at to knowing that some things are not going to change. And so how do you persuade them to believe in the illusion? So that's the whole purpose of the debate. But then when people wake up and they realize that they truly do have the power and that's what they know, and that's why they keep feeding us with negativity because our minds are suppressed. When your mind is suppressed, you're not thinking at your full capability and you're not knowing how to reason or comprehend or do constructive criticism or what's that word I'm looking for? When you be able to reason on your own, pretty much, And then you, what is it called, constructive thinking? What's the word they use in school when you have to, when you analyze
critical
it? You have to analyze everything. So a true person who has understanding, wisdom, and knowledge will be able to dissect what they're saying and take what they need and to move forward and create their own reality or create their own way of what needs to happen. So they're not waiting on the sidelines for them to be like, oh, we need to be fed. For instance, with the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers are the ones who started the food program. They wasn't waiting for the government. So that means you taking action. But then the government came in, and now you have school lunches everywhere, school programs everywhere. So it's like, okay, what do we do? As you say, we have to be our own savior, you know. And it's like we have to set our guidelines or whatever we want and move forward with it. And that's when it comes, you know, to the debating part. Because like you said, they're going to tell you what you want to hear. Oh, it sounds good. But then, shit, hold them to the fire. That's what we have to do. We have to hold them to the fire, have a plan, and then be able to execute it. And that's where the power comes from, because you're not being led by what someone else is saying because the debate sounds good or the persuasion sounds good. So you have to use your mind, use your intuition, and use your discernment to know who's lying and who's not lying and what you want to do as a collective to move forward for the betterment of the human race.
I couldn't have said it any better than that.
All right.
I just have one thing to add, though. My next segment just got deleted off my computer. So it's going to take a minute to get it back. So if we could just move along, I can run it back in a couple of minutes once I get everything set up.
Okay. We're going to continue on with Walter Pierce.
Yes. And again, good morning, everybody. And for the first first segment of the day, it's going to be two diamonds. And the intro for diamond is, history is like a diamond. Each prism represents the work of a group of people at a particular period of time. Look into the diamond and see the reflections of your past self, the pain of your mother, the choice of your father, and the blood of your ancestors. Look deeply, and you are bound to find yourself. And for our first diamond of today, of two, his name is James Weldon Johnson. Away with words. Now see, these words were beautiful that will be sung long after James Weldon Johnson was dead. In 1900, James wrote this verse to music composed by his brother John. Their song, Lift Every Voice and Sing, became known as the Negro National Anthem. Generations of Black people have sung their song with pride. James was an educator, poet, novelist, diplomat, and civil rights leader. He cared deeply about his people and worked to improve their lives. In 1920, he became the executive secretary of the NAACP. Black culture was important to James. He wrote many important books about Black people's contributions to music, religion, and theater. He also wrote a novel called The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. James also served as a diplomat and consul for the United States in Venezuela. And yeah, that concludes a little short piece on James Weldon Johnson. But the biggest thing that me and Mr. Bay talked about earlier this week, we was discussing the song, how, you know, I believe a lot of people don't actually know about it, and they don't understand the background of the song. And, you know, the reason is, of course, you have the American National Anthem being played, but some of the times you don't have the Negro National Anthem that you hear a lot. And I used an example earlier this week that I said that I asked a couple times when, you know, I was in school and we would play this song because our school was primarily an African-American group of kids. And we played this song, and I don't know, like outsiders, you know, who come to visit because either we have a ceremony or something like that, you know, it was a white, one of the white guys, and he questioned one of the students saying, oh, is this a school song? Not realizing that this is the Negro National Anthem, and this song is a big thing for us. So it's just something that I believe is not recognized enough and not known. You know, when you think about the Negro National Anthem, you think about the lyrics and you think about the meaning behind it, and this song. Really, in particular, it uplifts us and it motivates us, and it talks deeply to us about who we really are, and how if we lift our voices and sing, we could become something great, and we could really unite each other. So, you know, and also another question that was related to me was, like, how was it played, and how was it during my school, and how much it was played. And, you know, me growing up, I went to primarily African-American schools. So, you know, this song is mostly played as much as the American National Anthem every day to let us hear about it. And also during our ceremonies, which is something I believe is good for kids to understand where this song comes from. And yeah. You know, he also part of the, not only did he create that song, he was somebody who was serious about helping his people. You know, he was a part of the NAACP. He, the executive secretary of that. So he was somebody who was always involved in civil rights and for his people. And just his song is so iconic. And I just wish that a lot more people would start to know and learn about this song. And thank you.
Okay. Tanisha, I'm going to come right to you. Do you have a question or a comment?
I guess I have a comment. Yeah, that's I love that song. And like you said, it's not played as much as it needs to be played. But I guess amongst us it's played a lot because it's our song. But I understand in general it should definitely be played. Like if they play the national anthem, they should definitely play that. Like to me, I think they should play the indigenous anthem. And they should play that anthem, our anthem, and I guess the American anthem. But I don't know. It's true. Yeah, like Walter said, when you lift your voice is a vibration, and that's very powerful because that means that you are in sync. And when you're in sync, you have the power to move things and manifest things. And that was the key. It's like when you hear something, it's you have to hear it on an esoteric level, because esoteric means that you're diving into it, you're dissecting it, you're understanding it from a spiritual aspect and also from a physical aspect. So physical aspect, yes, everyone comes together, they're united in song, but spiritual aspect, that means that you vibrate in the heavens so powerfully that the universe has to answer to you and move on accord. And that's, you know, that's what God is. God is that infinite energy that flows through us, you know, and that's what we need to be able to create this change that we need in this world.
Yep. Okay, Mr. Harris, you have a question or a comment?
It's more like a comment, you know, because even when I was going to school, we sang that song. And see, a lot of us have only sang like one verse. I think there's like 2-3 verses, and each one gets a little bit deeper about what he's actually trying to say. And because, you know, it started out as a poem that was just put to music, you know, and it says a whole lot about us. It says a whole lot about, you know, where we came and it kind of pointed a direction of where we needed to go. And it's something that everybody, not just people of color, need to be able to understand what's going on with that. And even sing it, just like Sis was saying. You know, everybody needs to sing it because there's more than just, the American anthem to America, because America's more than that, so we're more than just that one song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just would like to say, and I think the symbolism reflects a song of coming together and unity as a people. Mr. Harris, are you ready to go to your next segment?
Not just yet. He can do his own thing. By the time he's finished, I'll be ready.
Okay.
Yeah. And also to mention, he was also one of the leaders of the Harlem Renaissance, which is something that is prominent to our history because it was the revival of all of our arts and culture, which started to let people understand who they really are and their origin, which was something that was also a good accomplishment. Now, to the next segment of today, next person, because we're still doing diamonds, we're staying musical, and we're going to go right to the classical side of music, and we're going to be talking about Ulysses K. Now, see, some people believe that classical music was too difficult for black people to master. Men like William Grant Still, Dean Dixon, and Ulysses K. proved them wrong. These talented black men became outstanding composers and conductors. Ulysses K. decided to make music his career when he was young. He had always loved music, but he knew that he had to study hard if he wanted to succeed. He attended the Eastern School of Music, the Berkshire Music Center, and Yale University. He learned to compose. And after serving in the United States Navy during World War II, Ulysses quickly became the most important black composer of classical music in the United States. He received numerous awards, including the Gershwin Music Memorial Prize, a Broadcast Music Incorporation Award, and an American Broadcasting Company Prize. A couple of his pieces include A Short Overture and The Juggler of Our Lady, and it is his most popular works. Ulysses K. will be remembered not only as a great composer, but also as a black pioneer in classical music. All right, Ulysses K., everybody, so let's talk a little bit about why I actually picked him today. And when I was talking about it with Mr. Bay earlier, you know, he's also a resident of New Jersey. I believe T-Neck, and that's also one of the good reasons. But also another reason is mainly I used to play a classical instrument, the trumpet. And, you know, I played classical pieces when I was playing that instrument. So usually the songs that I would play was mostly by Italian, French, or just European composers. You know, most of the classical pieces that I would play. But, you know, I never really thought about it, but I've never really played something like a classical by a African-American man. And, you know, now I think about it, that would have been very interesting to learn more about black composers during that time I was playing a couple of years back, like two, three years back. You know, but like classical music is just, it's something that some people might find boring, but like for me, you know, even though it's not my favorite genre of music, it's still something I respect and love because of the way classical music could be used to like, literally, like playing classical music, you could just imagine things. You could literally build images in your mind and just understand each part of it, because each part of classical music you will hear different parts that you either it's, you know, it's a low part of the song, kind of sad, or it's a getting to the climax. It's like a movie, you know, classical music. It fits perfectly in movies, and I just love the rhythm of it. I don't know about other people, but I just love how many tones of sounds you can make in one song and just make it so intriguing for the audience to listen to. You know, that's my opinion. Now, I don't know about everybody else, but yeah. But, you know, just somebody who's a pioneer, you know, as well for black people to get involved in classical music and to be have this music in different movies. You know, I believe he should be somebody who's talked about a lot more, definitely, because for upcoming black musicians who play classical music, it will always be nice for them to know about pioneers like Ulysses K. and others who created classical music for them to play. And, you know, I would just like to get your opinion on it as well. So thank you for listening.
Okay, so we're going to start out with Tanisha Gardner. What do you think? You have a question or a comment?
I guess a comment. I guess classical music, I really don't listen to classical music, but like you said, in school, they taught you about, you know, Mozart and different composers. And I think it's very deep because it makes you want to do your own research. And that's what I was doing. I was just looking it up when Walter was speaking and how you have Joseph, who was born in 1745, and you have Florence Price in 1887. And William Grant Still in 1895. And it's like, wow, I never even heard of them. And it just makes you want to start doing your own research to see the impact and the power that we have in music. Because we always did music. Music is a vibration. And we always, you know, that is definitely a part of us. And no matter what we touch, it's like it's gold. And it's a beautiful thing. I'm talking on the phone and I'm not by anybody. Hello? I'm so sick of this shit.
Yeah.
I heard you. I'm going outside. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I guess that's going to have to be edited out. One of the things that I want to say is I beg to differ, and I think that classical music is something that is in movies and television, and I think that it's a subliminal message that's in a musical underscore for movies and television. And a lot of times you'll find that you don't even realize that the music is there. Mr. Harris?
Absolutely. And a lot of stuff, what they call classical music, you know, a lot of the instruments that they use in classical music were traditional African instruments, like the piano and all these other things. And people don't understand that we've been kind of prominent in classical music for a long time, you know, because Beethoven was a so-called mulatto, which means he was a person of color. And, you know, and he was really known as being one of the giants in classical music. Whenever, and anything that comes down to something that really speaks to us on a spiritual level, we usually have our hand in a lot of that, you know, and this is just something that it just continues as we go on. Again, I'm not a classical music listener, but I understand that it's about different techniques and different sounds, and, you know, and it's all good. Because Duke Ellington said there's only two kinds of music, good music and bad music. So... And, you know, so you just got to understand that that's where we are at this time.
Okay. Now, James Weldon Johnson and Ulysses, what is the message that you're trying to get across when you talk about James Weldon Johnson, and what did you actually learn from doing research on James Weldon Johnson, Walter?
And I already know about his background of creating the song "Lift Every Voice and Sing," but other things I've learned, you know, I learned about the Harlem Renaissance and how he contributed to that part of history for Black people in Harlem. You know, the revival of your culture, getting people to understand what our culture was really like, and just getting to know yourself was something that is great to be a part of. And it's amazing, and it's a key milestone and achievement for Black people in history, in my opinion, you know? And then we We go into just all the leadership he has done with the NAACP as well. You know, he even fought in World War II, but like going into the NAACP, being a leader, being somebody who cared deeply about his people. He didn't just create a song, did the work as well, which is important for a lot of people to do. You know, they might say something, oh, I feel for these people, you know, let's make a song or let's make something dedicated to them. But are you really out there putting in the work? And that's what he was doing. You know, he made this song to uplift Black people, and he was out there uplifting and progressing the movement for Black people. And that's what I really liked about him, and that's what I learned about him mainly.
Okay. All right. Mr. Harris?
Okay. All right. One more time. All right. So this is kind of a different take on our traditional curtain segment. You know, it's more of a celebration of both a cultural and spiritual giving of this particular person. You know, because of the Ballad and the Bullet that we went over earlier, I was going to try to give a little piece on El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, or, you know, also known as Malcolm X. His original name was Malcolm Little. He was born on May 19th in 1925 in Omaha, Nebraska. And he was an African in America leader and prominent figure in the Nation of Islam, who articulated concepts of race pride and Black nationalism in the early 60s. Now, as a child, he excelled in school, but after his eighth grade teacher told him that he should be a carpenter instead of a lawyer, he lost interest in school and soon ended his formal education. You know, he was like most of us, we was a rebellious youngster, and he moved from the Michigan State Detention Home, a juvenile home in Michigan, to Roxbury to live with his half-sister, Ella. That's when he became involved in petty crimes as a teenager, known as Detroit Red for his reddish hair. And he developed into a street hustler, drug dealer, gang member in Roxbury and in Harlem. You know, after his time in jail, he got exposed to another way of thinking, and which led him to the Nation of Islam, where he had became one of the most articulate speakers in the Nation of Islam and helped grow the movement, like, dramatically. And in 1963, there was a deep tension between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad over the political direction of the Nation of Islam. And Malcolm urged that the nation become more active in widespread civil rights protests instead of just being a critic at this on the sidelines. You know, so, but Elijah Muhammad said that was against the nation's moral codes, and it would worsen relationships with him and Malcolm. And it got to the point where they had a beef between the two after Malcolm said, after John F. Kennedy was assassinated, that it was just an example of the chickens coming home to roost. You know, in the violent society, suffering the consequences of violence, and this is just what's going to happen. And his response was an outrage to this, and he ordered Malcolm to observe a 90-day period of silence, which turned into a permanent break. And in 1965, he founded the Organization of African American Unity. You know, it was a Islamic and Black nationalist like hybrid. And through that time, growing hostilities between Malcolm and the Nation of Islam led to death threats and open violence against him. On February 21st, 1965, he was assassinated while delivering a lecture at the Audubon Theater in New York, where three members of the Nation of Islam were convicted, even though I kind of think the FBI has something to do with it, but that's another story. And he was survived by his wife, Betty Shabazz, who he married in 1958 and had six daughters. His martyrdom, ideas, and speeches contributed to the development of Black nationalism's ideology in the Black Panther Party, and it helped to popularize the values of autonomy and or the do for self concept that a lot of people have been coming up with since then, you know. And I led that to believe because what he actually gave back was a way of critically thinking about your situation that you're in. And there's a, and it's being like used at the Shabazz Center over in 166th Street in Harlem. It was a part of the old Autobahn Theater. You know, after he was killed, the Autobahn Theater kind of closed down like right after that. And the city took it over in 1968. And his wife was like, they was going to tear it down. So his wife like got a grassroots community together to try to save the Autobahn Theater. And it's still, it's called the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center now. And it lends itself to different community groups to come over there. It talks about all the different things that Malcolm did and trying to uplift his legacy throughout his rest of his life. And that's, to me, I think that's really a great give back to the community, because even though it's been 55 years since he was killed, a lot of the things he was saying are still needed to be said today and kind of are not. And this is part of our issue that we have. And as a people, you know, we, like Paul Mooney said, we're under the illusion of inclusion. And it's really not really what's going on out here. And that was the curtain that I was pulling off, because a lot of people don't know about this center over in New York. It's on Broadway and 165th Street, right up there by Columbia College. So if you want to just go for a day with your family, that'll be a wonderful trip to take. You'll come out of there learning a whole lot.
Okay. Well, we're still in quarantine, pandemic mode. So the opportunity, I don't know is if it's available to be able to visit. But if there is a virtual visit available, I'm sure people would like to check it out. Tanisha, you have any question or comment?
I guess a comment makes you want to go there. I guess you could go online. Like you said, they should have a website. I'm gonna definitely check out the website. Oh, that'd be cool if Quest could do. You know, when we have chance, I guess when everything lightens up a little bit, well, that'd be nice if we could put together like a tour. You know, if someone, you know, get a couple of people who want to come with us and go as a group once the quarantine get lifted, that would be a really good trip to go on.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay. All right, we're going to go back to Walter.
Yeah. I guess I could continue with the with our segments for today. Me and Mr. Bay had a conversation earlier this week discussing the topic racism and racist. And if the word racist is used too much in society today. And we got into a slight disagreement, but at the end of the day, we understood each part was coming too. And basically, why I'm bringing this up is I was having a conversation again with in school with a teacher and classmates, and we were talking about how you don't want to call everybody a racist, but some of their words and actions can be, you know, that might be hard to understand, but I believe in calling people ignorant and prejudiced before I actually call them just a pure racist, you know. And the reason is because of how some of these young people, especially how they grew around just all these different ideologies and constantly be thrown in their brain, and we're not giving them a chance. And them not getting a chance to or understanding the other side, you know, just being constantly contaminated with these ideas, it could really just harm somebody's mindset, you know? And what I've seen recently is I've seen people who have these ideas being able to come together with people and listen to what another side has to say and understand why the things they are thinking is wrong. And they, you know, they'll change their ways of thinking. I've seen that recently. You know, I watched the film, I don't know if anybody else watched The Color of Fear. And, you know, the guy, one of the guys who was a white American, basically introduced himself as saying he's a racist. And he shut up for the entire show and just listened to what other people of color had to say about the topic and other things regarding race and society. And him understanding the fact that he wants to listen to another side, another perspective of people's thinking, really changed his mindset and what he was doing. But then I'm glad they had another example. They had another guy who was also a white American who would just decline all these things and say he loves all people. But in reality, during out the show, he was just too ignorant and always against what the people of color were saying. Saying one example was, he was saying how if colored people, colored black people, Latino people would just work harder and stop complaining and stop having and stop showing themselves as the victim to blame the white man, they'll progress in society. And that part really got heated in the part of that documentary. And he's just a person who doesn't understand his racism. I mean, yeah, his racism is prejudice. Those are people you could think of, the people who just say they're not and continue to do these things. And he doesn't even see his own ignorance, his own prejudice and all that. So that was a couple of things I was talking about with him. But I would also like for them to hear your perspective, and then we could bounce right back to me and not talk about it.
Okay, so basically, Walter raises the question, is the word racist or racism thrown around and used too frequently? That's the question. So I'm going to go to you, Mr. Harris, first.
Yeah, well, racism, really, it's a tactic in order to have a minority of people control the majority of the people. It really has no power in itself unless you actually believe it. You know, it's because the whole idea of different shades of people leading to different characteristics of people was something that didn't come up until like the 1600s with a guy named Carl Linnaeus. You know, he was a biologist or something like that. And, you know, a lot of people believe stuff if they say a scientist said so, or it was somewhere in a book and I read that this was this, so it must be true. But a lot of it, what has been done is just, it's just a matter of control. And it's a matter of, it's not a matter of color as much as it's a matter of we're in an actual race. We're in an economic race for control of the planet. And seeing that white people put themselves in the head of the race, everybody else is trying to follow their lead. And because that's not your natural tendency, you're going to always lose if you don't understand the rules to the actual race. And this is what's happening with a lot of people today. And like you were saying, a lot of it is ignorance. And a lot of it is people wanting to assimilate instead of being free. Those are two different things that we really have to understand. Freedom isn't something that, like we were saying in here, your definitions, you need to understand what your definition is, or you can't let other people define words for you. You know, freedom is being free of the need to be free. And this is what racism is, a barrier to people, you know, achieving that kind of freedom. That's what I think.
Okay. Tanisha, the question, well, you heard the question. Do you have a comment?
I guess that's that. That was the whole reason why they were trying to leave Europe, because they was being oppressed and they wanted to be free to believe in their beliefs. And so when they came over here with their sadistic ideologies, and they already are they racist? I'm not going to say all of them are racist, but I guess when you look out through history, and I guess the upper echelon, the one who controls and dictates how things should be, is definitely racist. Or they're just like so oblivious with negativity, they cannot see anything good. So I'll put it like that. I won't even say they're racist. They're so oblivious to negativity that they cannot see good. So if they cannot see good, it's like a lost cause. And then from that, and then it perpetuates back down, because so many people are brainwashed or they're followers and they don't know how to think for themselves. So they feel as though that's when the white privilege come into. So it's like, how do we break down? You break down, but like you said, communicating, understanding, having empathy, having sympathy. You know, you don't have to like me. You don't have to be my friend, but you have to respect me at the end of the day. And that's what it boils back down to. Of you know, principles and morals and respecting one another.
Right. Okay. So when Walter and I originally had this discussion, I started out by saying that, you know, it wasn't black people who created redlining in the neighborhood. It wasn't black people who denied a certain we didn't deny ourselves access to certain water fountain places in society. We didn't start segregation. In fact, many times we've been on the brunt. We've been the people who had to bear the burden of prejudice, prejudice. The ignorance and the whole thought of someone seeing themselves as privileged and above. And Mr. Harris went to the origins and how it's not the race that you think, it's the race against who's going to lead the world. And so, and I also mentioned that in most instances when African Americans have been degraded, we have turned the other cheek and forgiven in practically every situation. And so if the shoe fits, wear it, is what I'm trying to say. But I understand giving the word a different meaning, but it is what it is, because I ask, you know, I think, Walter, you're clear that African Americans cannot be racist, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So, with 2 minutes to go, Val, are you there?
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. How are you?
Okay,
we have four
so
days
more
left.
Say it again?
We have 4 days, 3 days until Election Day.
Okay.
And over three million people have already voted.
Okay.
They do have a website. It is called New Jersey Votes. If you have any question regarding whether your ballot was received, most people have received or are going to receive verification cards in the mail that, you know, their ballot was received. But if you, you know, still have questions or want to find out, go on New Jersey Vote to check out any information that you need regarding the election. But Election Day is Tuesday. Please get out and vote.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm going to go to Ms. Gardner. Tanisha, tell us, why is it important to get out there and vote?
I guess to play the game. besides play the game, so you can have a voice. And then when they don't do what you want, then you could hold their asses accountable.
Okay. No tea for the fever. We're just going to burn it out. Mr. Harris, why is it important to, get out and vote?
Well, it is a game, but it's a game, but it's not a checkers game. It's a chess game. We have to start making moves politically, because if this is going to be the society we're going to be in, the true power is held by the people who wield the power, who wield the money, who can say what can be done and what can't be done. And sometimes you got to have a dog in the fight, and we have to stop letting other people pick our dogs for us, and we have to understand that even though money dictates who gets elected, we don't have to fall for that. We could just vote for whoever's going to be dealing with our best interests. And it's important on that level, because we can't assume that this is going to be our end-all and do-all just because we voted for somebody. We still have to be doing community work and stuff within our own neighborhoods to, uplift ourselves. Then we could use whatever we can get from them. But that's just, a secondary thing. But it's important that we have a dog in the fight.
Okay. All right. Walter, I'm going to ask you to close us out.
Yes, and I thank everybody for listening to another edition of Quest Community Vibrations. We're live on 89.5. We have a rerun show running at 7 a.m., I believe. So make sure if you want to hear our shows in the past, you listen to that show on WSOU 89.5 FM.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's going to be a wrap. And until next week, we'll see you. Thank you, everyone. Peace.
Peace.